certainly, Theresa May is not blameless and has made a series of bad decisions along the way. One of the first bad decisions she made was by holding snap elections within a year after she became prime minister. David Cameron had called the referendum. He resigned when he lost. She became prime minister. She decided before she started negotiations with the EU to have snap elections. She thought she was going to win. This would bolster her position. And she ended up having a terrible result. She lost the Conservative Party majority in Parliament. The UK isn't really a two-party system. I mean, you definitely have the Conservative and the Labour Party as the majority parties. The Liberal Democrats, with some decreasing influence, Scottish National Party. But what was quite striking about the result of Theresa May's election was that she had to go into coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland. So the hardline Unionist Party in Northern Ireland has 10 MPs that are propping up Theresa May's government. And so that was one of the first things that really tied her hands in terms of how she was able to negotiate.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 12th, 2019. On March 29th, in approximately 6 weeks, the United Kingdom is scheduled to crash out of the European Union. As of this recording, there is no deal governing how that exit will work. To understand the stakes, Benjamin Wittes sat down in the New Jungle studio last week with Amanda Sloat, a senior fellow at the Brookings Center for the United States and Europe, to talk about all things Brexit. They talked about the thorny issue of the Northern Ireland border, Theresa May's delicate political position, and what might happen if March 29th arrives without a Brexit deal. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 391, Amanda Sloat on all things Brexit.
Let's start with an overview of the current lay of the land for the tiny fraction of Lawfare listeners who have not been obsessively following every incremental development in the Brexit stuff. What's going on? Where are we? And how ugly is it?
Well, and shame on everyone for not following incrementally this very fascinating soap opera. So if we go back a couple weeks, you may remember that Theresa May was supposed to bring a vote to the House of Commons on her Brexit deal in December. It was very clear at that time that there was not sufficient support in Parliament for her deal. So she kicked the ball down the road a couple of weeks, hoping that merriment over the Christmas and New Year holidays would help focus people's minds. Many people in her own party were unhappy with her decision to delay the vote. They called a vote of no confidence in her leadership, which she won, which means she cannot be challenged by her party as leader for a year. So fast forward to January 15, and the House of Commons finally got a chance to vote on her deal. It was a catastrophic loss for Theresa May, the largest defeat that any British prime minister has suffered in modern British history. The Labour opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, then called a vote of no confidence in her government. So the entire House of Commons got to vote on this. She also won that vote of no confidence. So even though people don't like her deal, they don't necessarily want to move to a general election or see Corbyn become the prime minister. So a week later, on January 21, Theresa May came before Parliament, talked about the bill's defeat, talked about her next steps on the way forward. A week after that, on January 29th, which is 2 months to the day before the UK is scheduled to leave the EU, the British Parliament finally got the chance to debate its alternatives to this. And this was supposed to be the day that the British Parliament was going to take control of the Brexit process. They did not, in fact, take control and sent out rather contradictory messages instead. They had the opportunity to vote on a couple of amendments that would have been legally binding and forced the British government, if there was no deal by the end of February, to go to the EU and ask for a delay in the Brexit process to allow more time. The Parliament chose not to adopt the legally binding matters and instead passed an advisory non-binding opinion, essentially saying they would strongly prefer it if the UK did not leave the EU without a deal. The other thing that they rallied around was support for amending the backstop to Northern Ireland, which really has been the crux of the problem with Brexit. So they have sent Theresa May back to Brussels, where she went on February 7th, to try and negotiate something that the EU has been very clear from the beginning that they are not going to renegotiate.
All right. So there's like a gazillion things in there. There you've got the British domestic politics of the thing, and you've also got the impending, looming no-deal Brexit thing going on there. And you've also got the state of negotiations with the EU. So let's start with the simplest one, which I think is the state of negotiations with the EU, right? Because correct me if I'm wrong here, but from the EU's point of view, there's a deal. And they're not interested in reopening this deal. And the catastrophe is all on the British side. And so Theresa May can fly back and forth to Brussels all she wants. But is there any realistic prospect that the EU side is going to open up this deal that they cut with her?
So when we talk about the deal, it's important to clarify that there's two documents. One is the withdrawal agreement, which is essentially the divorce settlement. The EU has been very clear that they do not want to reopen that, because once you reopen it to renegotiate one thing, it potentially paves the way for member states to try and renegotiate other components. The second document is non-legally binding, and it deals with the future relationship of the UK's relationship with the EU. It essentially sets out a set of guiding principles that would guide negotiations, if there is a deal, over the 21-month transition period about what the future of the UK and EU relationship is going to look like. The EU has said it's possible to make some tweaks to this future perspective of what the relationship looks like. The big issue has to do, again, with this backstop for Northern Ireland, which, just as a refresher, is a mechanism that is meant to protect the border in Northern Ireland, the sanctity of the peace process in Northern Ireland, by dealing with the fact that once the UK leaves the EU, that is going to become the external border of the EU's economic market, which means that you're going to want to have some sort of customs controls on goods that might be passing from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland, which is essentially the EU. And so what Theresa May initially said after the vote failed was that she was going to go to Brussels and wanted to talk about a unilateral exit, a time limit, or unspecified alternative arrangements to the backstop. The EU has been very clear that they are not going to do any of these three things. And if you look at all the politicking in London, it really goes to show that you do need to have some sort of backstop mechanism in place in order to protect the Irish border. Theresa May gave a large speech in Belfast on February 5th, and in that speech, she reasserted her commitment to keeping the backstop in the withdrawal agreement, which means the only things that she can renegotiate with the EU are the potential for an exit or the potential for an expiry date. The EU, in trying to be helpful several weeks ago before her big vote in Parliament, sent a letter addressed to her, which she shared publicly, saying that the EU is not trying to use the backstop as a way of trapping the UK into a customs union eventually. And the backstop, remember, is an emergency measure that is only supposed to come into place if there is not a future relationship negotiated between the two sides. So it's only supposed to be used as an insurance policy. So one possibility is whether or not they negotiate some sort of legal codicil to the withdrawal agreement. So that prevents the EU from having to reopen the withdrawal agreement. It potentially provides some additional assurances. But the question that the EU has is, even if we do any of this, can you get it through Parliament? Because the EU is not going to want to do something that Theresa May pockets, which still is not going to get the deal through Parliament.
All right. So let's hold the parliamentary side. When the Brexit vote first happened, I don't recall a whole lot of people, except maybe you, saying, keep your eye on Ireland. The Northern Irish border is the thing that's going to be the final, the big problem here. So why is, I mean, it seems like a huge amount of this comes down to that border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. There used to be a border there. There hasn't been a border there for a while. Why is so much riding on the question of a border in Ireland? The whole thing kind of comes down to that. Is this the issue that EU-UK negotiations are foundering over?
I did write in Foreign Policy 2 weeks after the Brexit referendum that Northern Ireland was going to be an issue. So if you were paying attention to British politics and especially sensitive to the issue in Northern Ireland, it's not really a surprise. Although you're right, it did not feature strongly in the referendum campaign and I think really caught a lot of people off guard. I think a lot of the English members of Parliament that are arguing about this are not particularly concerned about Northern Ireland or about the peace process in Northern Ireland. I think what this comes down to is questions of sovereignty and status. What the backstop essentially says is that Northern Ireland, although under protest about treating Northern Ireland separately from the rest of the UK, was expanded to all of the UK, is going to be in a customs union with the European Union if a future trade agreement is not reached between the UK and the EU. So for people that are supportive of Brexit and want to have the UK leave the EU in order to free it up to negotiate its own free trade agreements with other countries, for them, the perception of being trapped in a customs union means that it diminishes their economic sovereignty. And so the concern is not really with Northern Ireland. It's not really with the people that live along the border, the inconveniences to them, the political repercussions of having borders go up again and having checkpoints and infrastructure going up again after 20 years of these things coming down as part of the Good Friday Agreement. The issue really has to do with the future of the UK's relationship with the EU and a fear that they are going to be trapped in economic arrangements that they can't separate from.
But why is that the answer to that, not the backstop only goes into effect if you can't negotiate an agreement?
That is the answer.
So negotiate an agreement.
Absolutely. And now, if you talk to the Brits, they will say, we from the beginning wanted to negotiate both of these things at the same time. We wanted to negotiate the divorce and we wanted to negotiate the future. What the EU has said is you need to finalize the divorce and ratify those agreements first, and then we will hash out the future relationship. So the way this is all currently sequenced is the UK needs to ratify the withdrawal agreement. They need to implementing legislation. Brexit happens on March 29th. And then there's a 21-month transition period where nothing on the ground really changes. And during that 21-month transition period, which could be extended, the UK and the EU negotiate their future relationship. So if during that 21-month period they negotiate some sort of free trade agreement, some sort of long-standing customs union, this Northern Ireland backstop never comes into effect. So in a sense, the argument is not really about the backstop, but it's people trying to hash out the questions of this future relationship. And the EU is not prepared to have that conversation until the exit arrangements are in place.
All right. I want to throw out an idea and then have you shoot it down if it's wrong, which is that the sort of game theory of this relationship is that Britain votes for this with the understanding that they were reestablishing sovereignty. And then are shocked to discover that, in fact, all of the power in the negotiation is on the EU side. So the result is when you have this March deadline coming, it is bad but tolerable from an EU perspective to go in with no agreement. But it is a disaster from the UK perspective to have no agreement. And the result is that you end up with agreements like the backstop that actually potentially from a UK perspective undermine the sovereignty point, which was the central point of doing it in the first place. And so caught between a rock and a hard place as a result of their own voting behavior, they are flailing angrily.
Yes. That is accurate. There is an additional irony from the Irish perspective, which the EU has rallied around in these negotiations, which is that for Ireland, it is not an economic sovereignty issue the way it is for people in the UK. There are genuine concerns about the Irish border. They obviously have economic interests in preserving trade that runs from north to south on the island, but they also have concerns about the peace process. If there is no deal, by definition, there needs to be a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. So by staking the withdrawal agreement on maintaining the backstop in its current form, could prevent the UK Parliament from ratifying the withdrawal agreement, which could lead the UK to leaving the EU with no deal, which by definition would bring back the border. And so game theory from the Irish perspective is, what do you do then? The very mechanism you created to prevent the outcome you didn't want ends up leading to the outcome you don't want.
All right, so let's back up here and talk about that border for a minute and why it matters. Why is it a significant thing that the current status quo is that there is no border there, that a no-deal Brexit implementation brings back a border, and to what extent is this really about trade and free movement of peoples? To what extent is it really about the Good Friday Accords? And to what extent is it really about sovereignty on the island of Ireland?
It's definitely about the first two. So last year marked the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And part of the beauty of the Good Friday Agreement was that both the UK and Ireland were members of the European Union. So for people living in Northern Ireland, nationalists that ultimately supported reunification had a greater say in the region's governance through the establishment of a Northern Ireland Assembly. There was a large number of north-south structures that were put into place. And for unionists, they no longer had to worry about the fact that nationalists, the IRA, were going to engage in some of these terrorist activities because there had been decommissioning, there had been a process of disarming, and they knew that the only way this constitutional question was going to get resolved was through a referendum. And there was also East-West institutions that were put into place to keep Northern Ireland and Ireland in communication with the rest of the UK. So what Brexit has done has really brought back this old polarization, orange and green, as people in Northern Ireland will say, between Catholics and Protestants, Unionists and Nationalists. And so it's been quite psychologically devastating, I think, to people living there because it has brought back all of these identity questions and these constitutional questions that people didn't have to focus on for the last 20 years. You're starting to see opinion polls suggesting that large numbers of people in Northern Ireland who voted for Brexit, many of which are part of the unionist community, are prepared to sacrifice the peace process as a means of actually implementing Brexit. At the same time, you're seeing people that wouldn't necessarily vote for reunification believing that if you had a hard Brexit and a reimposition of a hard border, they would be more likely to support reunification of the island as a result of that. So you have a lot of psychologically devastating developments happening in Northern Ireland, given how much this has roiled the political process there. You certainly have a lot of economic impracticalities. I mean, if you think about people living in Washington, D.C., who live in Virginia and work in Washington, if you suddenly had a border on the bridge between Washington and Virginia and you had to get checked every time you came into work or every time you went out to shop at the outlet malls, it's very inconvenient. So there's very clear economic inconveniences that happen there as well. Another anecdote that I heard when I was there last spring that struck me is if you think about Baileys, the drink, the milk that goes into the Baileys tends to be produced in Ireland. That milk can cross that north-south border up to six times before it's sent to England and combined with the alcohol and processed. So again, if you suddenly have border checks there, very inconvenient. The bigger problem is the psychological devastation of all of that. As part of the Good Friday Agreement, the further integration, these border and checkpoints came down. And so in many places, if you think about the U.S. and Canada, you can have some sort of cameras, you can have very minimal checks. Given the political sensitivities in Northern Ireland, that's very, very difficult. So what's likely to happen, and the police commissioner in Northern Ireland is warned against this, is if you have any sort of physical infrastructure, it becomes a target for violence. So the camera gets damaged. You now need somebody to go and repair the camera. The individual repairing the camera now is the target for violence. And so maybe the police need to repair the guy who's repairing the camera. And just a final point to reinforce how destabilizing this has been. This past January marked 2 years that Northern Ireland has not had a government, which is pretty extraordinary. Last summer, it made Northern Ireland the world record holder for the place that had gone the longest without a sitting government. So there's no functioning local government in Northern Ireland right now, no prospect of that being stood up again. And second, a couple weeks ago, there was a car bomb that exploded in Northern Ireland's second largest city. In the past, this probably would have made American national news. It certainly would have made British national news, but it almost went unnoticed anywhere, which just goes to show that some of these dissident elements are still alive in Northern Ireland and that we can't take a sustained peace process there for granted.
All right. So just to sum up the equities here, from an Irish perspective, you want no border. And for there to be no border, the customs union with the EU has to extend to include the Northern Irish side. From anyone living on the Irish island point of view, it's majorly inconvenient for there to be a border, and it potentially erodes, from a Northern Irish point of view, the settlement of the Good Friday arrangement, which is already under some stress for reasons having nothing to do with any of this. And from a British point of view, a UK point of view, if you do Brexit while including the Northern Ireland side in the European customs union, you effectively divide Britain. It has an anti-sovereignty implication for Britain. And oh, by the way, it also increases the historical Irish claim for sovereignty over the entire island. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's generally right. I mean, if you think back to when the backstop first emerged, the plan was for Northern Ireland only to remain part of the EU's customs union. And this was objectionable to many of the democratic unionists in Northern Ireland and to some others in the UK because it treated Northern Ireland separately from the rest of the UK, which is what led to the backstop and the customs union being expanded to include all of the UK. So another possibility, which would make the democratic unionists unhappy, but you could potentially shrink the backstop back to Northern Ireland only. The broader problem is, even if you get past this hurdle, whatever sort of economic relationship the UK is going to have with the EU, free trade agreement, customs union not, is going to have this issue of the Northern Ireland border at heart. Because the reality is, the further the UK diverges from the European Union in regulatory and other terms, makes it easier for them to negotiate free trade agreements with third countries, but it increases the need to have customs and regulatory checks on goods going from Northern Ireland into Ireland. And that's what makes this so complicated, because the border really is going to be central to whatever form of economic relationship the UK and the EU ultimately have.
And just for people who aren't familiar with the relationship between the member states and the UK, Ireland has no authority to negotiate this on its own, right?
Correct. There had been some suggestions by British politicians that perhaps the UK and Ireland could negotiate their own separate free trade agreement or economic relations that would negate the need for the backstop. But the reality of the way the EU single market works is that the EU functions as a single economic bloc. And so Ireland does not have the authority to negotiate something separately with the UK because Ireland, of course, is remaining part of the European Union.
And Ireland, as best as I've been able to determine the Irish position as distinct from the EU position, there is a kind of a little bit of a smug toward the UK. You guys dug yourselves into this whole bucko attitude, you know, we're throwing our lot in with the EU. Is that roughly where they are, or is there any sympathy with the UK position in any of this?
There is some. I mean, another one of the sad byproducts of this Brexit debate has been the increase of tension between the UK and Ireland. Ireland, of course, used to be part of the UK, got its own independence in the 1920s, which is when the situation with Northern Ireland arose. So there have also been suggestions by English politicians that perhaps Ireland could simply rejoin the UK, and that would end up negating the need for this backstop conversation.
And Jordan is the Palestinian state.
I mean,
it's exactly the same. Like, if you would simply adopt our view of the conflict, all the problems go away.
Absolutely. And there had been a lot of positive things that happened in recent years. You know, the Queen visited Dublin. She shook hands with, you know, former leader of Sinn Féin. So there had been a lot of reconciliation between the two countries. One of the things that Irish officials will lament is that they're no longer going to have the opportunity to engage as frequently as they had been doing with their British counterparts at all of these EU meetings. And if you talk to people in Dublin, The phrase that people kept using was paddywhackery, this idea that English politicians in particular are using slurs against the Irish. You know, why can they not pronounce Taoiseach, you know, the Irish word for the prime minister in Ireland? Why can they not pronounce these Irish names after all of these years? Why are they still talking about us like we're a colony? You know, any sense of smugness in Dublin, I think, is tempered by a genuine sense of hurt about the way that a lot of English politicians have been talking about them and a lot of the really outlandish suggestions that have come up. There's also been politicians suggesting that the Good Friday Agreement is out of date, it's not needed, that Ireland is simply trying to play games. Nothing about Brexit is good for Ireland. It's problematic to the Northern Ireland peace process. It's going to be damaging to the Irish economy and makes things very politically complicated for them. And any sort of sense that there should be an Irexit, that Ireland should leave as well, they're very quick to dismiss. They recognize the economic benefit that they have gotten. And for a small country, they realize that their voice has been amplified incredibly by being part of this EU platform.
There is no substantial question in Ireland about whether it should be part of the EU.
No, none at all. None at all.
All right, let's turn to the British domestic politics of this. So you started with this account of Theresa May's woes. I cannot think of a politician in any parliamentary system who has suffered the kind of devastating policy setbacks that she has and yet survived no confidence votes, both in her own party and in the parliament as a whole. And so the parliament's attitude toward Theresa May, as best as I can understand it, is she should under no circumstances get anything she wants, nor should she be able to resign. Or, right? I mean, like, she should just be forced to stand there, like, in chains if necessary while we flog her. Like, what's in this for her?
That is quite an image. I'll never forget a tweet last year by Christine Warmoth, a former senior official in the Pentagon, who said that Theresa May reminded her of the smart girl in class who was in charge of the group project. And I actually think that's the best description. It's the girl who's got all of these delinquent boys who are screwing around and not taking the project seriously. Theresa May, remember, supported remaining in the EU, so she doesn't even believe in the idea of Brexit herself. But by God, she has been given the task of delivering Brexit upon the democratic will of the people, and she's going to do it. And I think that image really best encapsulates the way that she has been going about this task.
All right. So I that all sounds a little bit more sympathetic to Theresa May than I personally feel, because on the one hand, I agree. Yeah, she didn't support this. She's was kind of handed this rotting carcass. On the other hand, she has not said, number one, there should be a second referendum. She has not resisted. This is a 52% majority that voted for something that is likely to be catastrophic for her country. And one part of leadership might be saying, hey, I oppose this for a reason, and it's that it's a terrible idea. And everything that has happened for the last 2 years since we've done this has validated that. Let's slow this process down and figure out whether there is an off-ramp and whether we want it. She hasn't done any of that. And by the way, her opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, also won't do that, right? And so you have a broad proposition that was passed by a tiny minority that probably couldn't pass again today if it were subjected to another vote. And you have a two-party system, or the two major parties, neither of which meaningfully opposes it. And so I want to start with a system failure question, which, like, what is wrong with the British political system? And we spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the dysfunction of our political system with regard to sort of fateful choices. But what is wrong with the British political system such that there is a two-party system a fateful and obviously terrible national decision, and neither party is meaningfully opposing the inexorable movement toward this catastrophe.
A lot there to unpack. Certainly, Theresa May is not blameless and has made a series of bad decisions along the way. One of the first bad decisions she made was by holding snap elections within a year after she became prime minister. David Cameron had called the referendum. He resigned when he lost. She became prime minister. She decided before she started negotiations with the EU to have snap elections. She thought she was going to win. This would bolster her position. And she ended up having a terrible result. She lost the Conservative Party majority in Parliament. The UK isn't really a two-party system. I mean, you definitely have the Conservative and the Labour Party as the majority parties. The Liberal Democrats with some decreasing influence, Scottish National Party. But what was quite striking about the result of Theresa May's election was that she had to go into coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland. So the hardline Unionist Party in Northern Ireland has 10 MPs that are propping up Theresa May's government. And so that was one of the first things that really tied her hands in terms of how she was able to negotiate. They are the ones, for example, that rejected this initial form of the backstop that was only specific to Northern Ireland. Second, you're absolutely right that she has made the negotiating process much more complicated. And in particular, she drew several red lines that made it very difficult to negotiate and essentially was looking for incompatible things. She wanted the UK to leave the EU customs union, but she also wanted everything to be treated the same. And so it was very difficult to be able to achieve everything that she was trying to negotiate. Third issue is the issue of Jeremy Corbyn. And that's also a very interesting political dynamic because there is a large percentage of the Labour Party that is opposed to Brexit. Jeremy Corbyn, actually in this opposite system from Theresa May, is supportive of Brexit. He has voted against every single treaty that the UK has had that has deepened its relationship with the European Union. And so he's not really leading a robust opposition to counter Brexit. He wants to have a general election so he can become prime minister, and he thinks that he would then be able to negotiate a better deal. And really, the bottom line with all of this is that there is not a clear majority in the British Parliament for any specific form of deal. And it's not even really a facet of the parties because there's divisions within the Conservative Party and there's divisions within the Labour Party. Theresa May, as I mentioned, in the Conservative Party wants to stay. Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour opposition party, wants to leave. And if you look back at the votes that Parliament took on January 29th, one of the amendments was put forward by a Labour member of Parliament that would have required the government to ask the EU for a delay to the process if there was not a deal by the end of February. Part of the reason that amendment failed was because there was a number of Labour MPs who opposed it. They represent constituencies that voted to leave. And so there's not even a clear consensus within these political parties about which way to go.
Okay, but there is a political party in the UK that stands strongly and unambiguously against Brexit. And the irony is—
Which party is that?
The Liberal Democrats. And the irony is that you started this by saying, in correcting me, that this is a two-party system. I meant sort of two major parties. But by saying, well, there's the LD and their kind of influences on the wane. And just as a matter of like evaluating a democratic polity, that's a shocking statement, right? That you have something that was passed with 48% of the people voting against it. 48% of the people is enough to win an election in the UK. And you have one political party that I suppose the Scottish Nationalists as well, but one political party that is national and unambiguously against Brexit, and its influence is on the wane.
That's true. Nobody even talks about the Liberal Democrats' vote in any of this.
Why are they not surging? Why is it that at this moment in time, you have two political parties, one of whom is run by a woman who you describe sympathetically, who is opposed to Brexit, but gamely leading the charge as the girl responsible for the school project. And the other one is somebody who, in fact, supports Brexit, but leads a party that much of which opposes it. And he's very cynically not getting in the way
because he wants to force a general election in which he will do whatever, then he, you know, a better deal, whatever that means. The result is that there's no national opposition to this path that they're on. There is a party that should be that, and its influence is on the wane, with 48% of the population 2 years ago having opposed this thing. I don't understand that. Why isn't this the golden age of the Liberal Democratic Party in the UK?
You're right. I mean, they've been almost completely absent from this debate. They don't feature in any of these large conversations. You have the SNP, you have the Democratic Unionist Party playing a much bigger role than the Liberal Democrats are, who have not even been as vocal in the parliamentary debates. Some of this, you know, you're seeing with the rise of this nonprofit organization that's calling for a people's vote, and this idea of trying to take the people to the street to try and demand that you have some sort of second referendum. The problem, again, with that is you don't have a sufficiently large number of people championing it within Parliament. And I think there's an argument that given that Parliament was unwilling to legally call for a delay in the process, it is very unlikely that there is going to be a majority in Parliament that is going to legally call to reopen this because of how divided the country is and also how divided the Parliament is within the parties and within the constituencies in terms of whether or not people actually support this.
All right. So given the dysfunction of the British domestic politics, the fact that the EU has no particular reason to compromise further than it already has in negotiating an agreement, that there are very substantial Irish equities that the EU is in fact championing and needs to champion for a member state against allowing for further concessions with respect to customs unions, and EU equities against allowing a customs union not to include the island of Ireland. I don't see how you don't have an agreement that is ratifiable by the March deadline. Is there any reasonable prospect of a rabbit being pulled out of the hat right at the end and there actually being a negotiated Brexit, or are we now realistically careening to a no-deal Brexit in March?
So what was really striking about the vote in Parliament on January 29th was you had a lot of criticism by Parliament, by the public, of Theresa May and her government for the very reasons that you laid out. Why is the government making this so complicated? The government is failing to deliver. The vote on January 29th was supposed to be the British Parliament's chance to take control of the process, and finally they were going to get to vote and put forward the way that they wanted to go. They did not do that. We are going to see a rerun of this February 13th and 14th. If Theresa May does not have a new deal, she has to come before Parliament on the 13th, and these members of Parliament in the UK are going to be spending their Valentine's Day having a rehash of all of these same debates and looking again at all of these options. I really think that the vote coming out of the 29th now narrows us down to two possible options. One is that you have a no-deal Brexit, like you said. The other possibility, and it's one that I've been somewhat sympathetic to, is that Theresa May does manage to get some sort of deal through Parliament. And now the comparator that people often use on this is the TARP scenario. So if you remember back in the United States in 2008, we had the financial bailout. The House voted on the legislation and voted it down. The Senate passed it and made a couple of tweaks. And there was incredible pressure from George Bush, who was president at the time, Barack Obama, who was the candidate at the time, on the House to pass the legislation. So at the moment when they were staring into the financial abyss, the House, particularly Democrats, who had been opposed to the idea of a bailout, held their nose, voted for it, and it passed. So there is a possibility that some sort of deal is able to get through. I think we saw an overwhelming defeat the first time because everybody recognized it was a vote that didn't really matter. It was essentially your free shot, and you could make your statement, and you could vote against it. I think this vote coming up on Valentine's Day is going to be significant because people are going to have to look much more closely at these options because they are 6 weeks away. So a lot of the effort in Theresa May's party is whether you can get enough Labour MPs who are going to be willing to support some sort of revised deal to try and get this through.
how big a swing do you need from the last vote to get a revote to actually pass?
The vote that failed in January was huge. I can't think of the numbers right off. I think it was almost 2-1, 3-1. I mean, it was a huge catastrophic defeat. So the question is whether you can get some of those people to come back on side with the idea of this sort of deal being better than no deal. So it's certainly going to be a heavy lift. But I really think at this point, these seem to be the two possibilities that we are looking at, which is either no deal or Theresa May's deal. It is also possible on Valentine's Day that this amendment comes back that was voted down at the end of January, which calls for an extension to this process. The way the originally worded amendment was written was that if there was no deal by February 26, the UK government would have to go to the EU and request an extension until the end of 2019. Now, the thing to remember with that is all of the other EU 27 members would have to agree to an extension. If the British Parliament adopted the deal, it is very likely that the EU would agree to a technical extension of several weeks. Once the UK passes this deal, it still has to pass implementing legislation, and the European Parliament also has to ratify the deal, which would be a given, but you need time for this. But if there is agreement on the deal, it's not really a problem to extend this a couple weeks to essentially allow the paperwork to flow through. What I think the EU is not prepared to do is to have another 6 months, 12 months of wrangling in London without any clarity about the future direction that they're moving in.
In other words, they want to verify that Britain is all in before they allow an extension.
Sure. If you need time to ratify, if there was going to be a second referendum, if there was going to be an election, if there was some extenuating circumstance that required more time, I think there would be a lot of openness to an extension. If we are going to have an extended period of uncertainty with no discernible outcome, there is not a lot of sympathy within Europe to doing that.
Okay, so if there's a prospect for a revote swinging the kind of numbers that it would take to swing, one thing that has to happen, as happened with the TARP vote. The TARP vote that you reference is a really interesting analog here because there was essentially nothing different in the second vote than in the first, except the impending doom of the financial crash. And one thing you have to believe is that the doom is real, because it is actually embarrassing to turn around and vote for something that you just voted against, literally without change or even time separating them. And that's an embarrassing thing for a politician to have to do. And you have to really believe that you're on the bus that is about to careen off the cliff. And so one of the things that I question about Brexit is whether a lot of British politicians really believe that the situation is that bad. And so now let's talk about what happens in March if there's no deal. All of a sudden, it's the 29th, right?
Yes.
March 29th, Britain's out of the EU, there's no deal. What happens when we wake up on March 29th without a deal?
I think it actually would be pretty bad. The main thing that happens is the UK is definitively out of the EU. There is no transition period. Everything that applied currently no longer applies. So on the economic side, the UK would go back to trading with the EU on WTO rules. So all of the preferential trading arrangements, customs arrangements that were put in place would no longer cease to exist. So you would have incredibly high customs on some products. You would have to have checks at all of the borders, the border in Northern Ireland. If you think about the trucks that are going from Dover in England to Calais in France, all of those goods would have to be checked, which means if you are shipping food, if you are shipping medicine, if you're shipping any sort of perishable good, leaving aside everything else in the supply chain, all of that is going to be delayed. There's people looking at open skies arrangements in terms of whether or not airplanes are going to be able to land in the UK. The rights of UK citizens living in the EU and EU nationals living in the UK are no longer going to be protected. There was an announcement that came out from the British government a couple weeks ago saying that payments that are given by the National Health Service to Brits who are living and retired in Europe would no longer necessarily apply. So everything would essentially grind to a halt. You would also lose this 21-month transition period during which future relationships would be negotiated, during which all of the current rules would remain in place for citizens and businesses to get used to them. There's been talks by people in the UK about stockpiling foods and medicine to be able to prepare for this. So certainly the focus then would become crisis management in terms of trying to cobble together a large number of agreements to deal with every single one of these trade, economic, legal issues that would have to be dealt with. And I think you're right. I mean, the similarity with TARP, I think, in this case would also be similar because it is very unlikely that Theresa May is going to get something significantly different in the agreement. They're not going to remove the backstop. I don't think they are going to time limit it or allow a unilateral exit. The closest would be some sort of legal codicil, similar to the letter that the EU sent to Theresa May in January, saying that the UK would not be indefinitely trapped in some sort of customs union with the EU. And so the question is whether this would be enough of a fig leaf to satisfy some people and whether this very real threat of the abyss of a no-deal Brexit would be enough to change people's minds.
And between those two eventualities, some kind of fig leaf leading to a revote with a huge swing of MPs versus the abyss and the actual no deal Brexit. How do you assign the probability between the two? We're less than 2 months out here. What do you actually expect to happen?
I honestly can't predict. This whole process has been very, very unpredictable. There's a lot of people that are accusing May of simply running down the clock. And the closer we get to that date, the bigger the abyss looks and the more people are likely to be scared into voting on this.
That's a reasonable play, in my view.
I mean,
if people are accusing her of that, if I were whispering in her ear, I would say get within 2 weeks of this and everyone will buckle.
There's certainly a school of thought. I think the EU also wonders if people in the UK are going to buckle. And so why are they going to start making concessions if those concessions are not going to guarantee parliamentary support, if those are simply going to be pocketed and lead to a demand for more? And so I think there's also a sense on the EU side that the UK simply is not ready to be serious about all of this yet. So really, I think both of these remain a big possibility. The one option we haven't talked about that I think is extremely unlikely but is possible is the UK could simply make all of this end. The European Court of Justice ruled last November that the UK could unilaterally rescind its invocation of Article 50, which was the treaty process that triggered negotiations, and say, you know what, this was all a big mistake. We changed our minds and we don't want to leave after all. So the UK actually does have this escape hatch that it could pull. But again, given Theresa May's very dogmatic belief in the need to fulfill this, it is extremely unlikely that that is a lever that she would choose to pull.
See my earlier point that you may be being a little bit too sympathetic and generous to her. Why isn't the right answer here for Theresa May to do that and immediately subject herself to an election? That I know you voted for this. I cannot in good conscience as the leader of the country allow the country to go into a no-deal Brexit. I have submitted the best deal I could negotiate. I am not going to drive this truck off a cliff. And if you want a prime minister who will, you are very welcome to elect a different one. And if my party wants a leader who will do it, it is very free to turn me out. Why is that not the right answer for her?
That's a good question. I don't have a good psychological analysis of May's approach to this other than what she seems to have communicated, which is she believes that the democratic will of the British people has been expressed and that it is her duty to implement that. Certainly, a lot of people would argue that there was misinformation during the Brexit campaign. There was certainly a lot of lies about what the costs and the benefits were going to be. And we've also seen a lot of Cambridge Analytica, Russian interference, disinformation that was feeding the referendum. referendum campaign. And so there is this growing movement within the UK to say, look, the government couldn't get a deal through. Parliament can't get a deal through. Let's let the people vote a second time. The problem, as we've been talking about, is that the parliamentary math simply isn't there. Theresa May, for her own dogmatic reasons, doesn't want to do it. Jeremy Corbyn, for his own belief in Brexit, doesn't want to do it. And you have enough of a divide with members of Parliament supporting Leave voting constituencies that they also don't want to pull the plug. And so I think the public outcry for a second referendum does not match the political realities that we're seeing in Westminster. The other challenge that you start to run into, which I think the EU could manage but is not convenient, is the timing of this. Academic experts have said it could take about 22 weeks to organize a referendum. Parliament would have to legislate on a referendum. Parliament would have to decide on the question for the referendum, which, given that they can't decide on what sort of Brexit they want, would make that a little complicated. There's questions about what that question would be. Do you say, do you want to have Brexit, yes or no, knowing what you know now? Is one of those options Brexit or Theresa May's deal? Or do you have a multi-part question where you say yes or no, and if no, then May's deal or some other deal. The thing that the European Parliament is concerned about is this May, we have elections to the European Parliament. The plan, of course, was Brexit was going to happen. British members were not going to stand for the European Parliament. Now, if the UK does not end up leaving, they would stand. And then the new Parliament sits in July. If Britain leaves, they reallocate all of those seats to other countries in a proportional way. And then in July, you start the new cycle of the EU with all of the funding decisions that would need to be made, which again goes back to what I had said earlier, that I think the EU is willing to give a couple weeks on a technical extension. If you start doing extensions until the end of the year, you run into some of these complications with the European Parliament elections. So again, I think there would be willingness on the part of the EU to do this if there was a genuine case to be made that something was going to change. But simply for more faffing about in London, there's not going to be support for that.
One last question. A disaster of this magnitude has to have somebody to blame. Whose fault is this?
I mean, the easiest person to blame would be David Cameron, who called the referendum in the first place. He seemed to think this was going to be a way to end this question within the Conservative Party. He thought this was going to be a way to secure his leadership, and it ended up achieving neither of those things. What's interesting is that recent interviews with David Cameron show that he does not seem to be losing any sleep over this and does not seem to particularly regret having called this referendum.
Amanda Sloat, thanks so much for joining us. I have a feeling this conversation is not over.
This will go on in some form or another for many, many years, I fear.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Amanda Sloat for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. This episode of the Lawfare Podcast was engineered by Michaela Fogel. It was edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.